Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Jay Lefkowitz, representing the appellants, and I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Please watch the clock.
Thank you. This is a classic case of overreach. California has a lot of tools with which to try to address its concern with the high cost of prescription drugs in the state. It can impose price caps. It can require all drugs to be sold to everyone in the state at the Medicaid rate. But the one thing it cannot do, which even the trial judge said would likely violate the Dormant Commerce Clause, is to regulate an entirely out-of-state settlement agreement just because that settlement may have an effect downstream in the state. That's exactly what AB 824 does. And under this court's en banc decision in San Francis, its more recent decision in the Daniel Sharp Smart case, both of which follow the Supreme Court's Healy and Baldwin cases, it's a straightforward application. And the test...
May I ask this question? California, in their brief, references Neville Bar Dairies v. Kraft Food, which says, at least with respect to California's antitrust and unfair competition statutes, it can regulate anti-competitive conduct occurring outside California when that has a in-state effect. Could you address their argument on that point?
Absolutely, Your Honor. This court recognized in Knievelbard, where it noted the importance of the fact that an integral component of the bid rigging scheme that the plaintiffs were challenging under the Cartwright Act took place in California. The court went out of its way to say it survived the Commerce Clause challenge because part of what was violating the Commerce Clause was the in-state conduct, the in-state sale. That's consistent with the way this court has looked at the Cartwright Act in the AT&T Mobility case as well. We're not saying that California doesn't have a lot of authority, obviously under the Sherman Act, even to regulate out-of-state settlements.
Well, are they arguing that they could regulate even if the state no sales took place in California? In other words, I read their brief as arguing that if sales took place, that they want to protect California consumers from sales in California that were based on these collusive, as they say, call them, settlements.
So two answers. First, the statute actually on its face doesn't in any way require any in-state sale. But even if somehow you were to construe it that way, or California were to say we'll only enforce it that way, the conduct that it would still be regulating is the out-of-state conduct. And that's exactly what took place in the Baldwin case, which was the unlikely unanimous decision of the Lochner Court. It said you can't sell milk in New York State if you enter into the type of transaction that we say is invalid in Vermont. The trigger of a sale in New York State doesn't save the statute. What would save the statute would be if this were like the foie gras or the shark fin case, where what is in fact being just regulated is in-state activity. And this court in the Rocky Mountain decision and Judge Hurwitz in your Oregon parallel case recognize the distinction. What made Rocky Mountain acceptable, this court pointed out, was that it did not impose penalties for non-compliant conduct that takes place outside of the state. That's the dividing line, and that's why this court in Knievelbard went out of its way to point out that part of what violated the Cartwright Act was the in-state activity. If California brought a Cartwright Act case with respect to a settlement, they would actually have to prove that the in-state sales violated the state law, that the in-state sales were anti-competitive. And sure, there might be some incipient conduct that was relevant to the case that took place out of the state. There might be some burden outside the state, but California would not be regulating outside of the state. And that's the bright line.
Mr. Lefkowitz, I'm sorry. I want to make sure Judge Acuda's... I thought she had another question.
I wanted to turn to the threshold issue of standing, but so if Judge...
So did I, so good.
Good.
Without focusing on the legal test for a second, let me just ask you what your client's declarations actually say.
Sure.
And let me tell you how I read them, and tell me if I'm wrong. None of them say they've ever entered into one of these agreements in the past, correct?
They don't say that because obviously all the settlements they've ever entered into are confidential. Settlements.
I know, but they don't. They could surely say, without describing any specific settlement, we've used this tool in the past. But they do not say that, do they?
That's correct. This court, though, respectfully, could take notice.
I'm not asking about the legal test.
Okay.
You can argue the legal test. I just want to make sure I know what they say. Nor do they say that we have any specific plan to enter into such an agreement in the future. Correct?
I'm not sure. I would completely agree, but
I'm sure.
I take your point.
Okay. Nor do they say a patent holder has called us up and said, gee, would you like to settle a case on this basis?
They haven't said those words. That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So focusing now solely on, now I want to ask you the legal question. Focusing now solely on the test for entering a preliminary injunction, which is that you have to face some imminent irreparable harm. And did the judge abuse his discretion in saying, as you suggest, maybe you got a good dormant commerce clause claim, but I don't see any irreparable harm pendente lite here.
So I'd like to give you two parts to that answer. One, I want to start with the affidavit and then go to the legal test. I'll focus on both the Coochley Declaration and the Matzik Declaration. One's at ER 153 and 4, and the other's at 157. They both basically say that in light of the massive penalties on the enforcement of a threat of ABA-24, these two companies are now going to have to incur significant costs continuing to litigate cases that they would otherwise settle. Now I hear
that they're going to do it. They say it's likely that they would do that in a very big way.
Sure. And if I may, Your Honor, this is not a situation like in the Thomas case, for example, where you had innkeepers who said, we're not going to change our conduct. And the court said, this is just far too speculative. We are dealing with active ongoing patent cases, and the affidavits do declare that there are dozens, if not hundreds, of active patent cases these companies are involved in. Once you're in a patent case, there are only two options. It's a binary world. You either enter into a settlement agreement or you litigate to conclusion. And although they haven't disclosed the terms of confidential settlements they are considering, in the five or six reported cases that address patent settlements in the Activists and Cartwright Act context, where the settlements are disclosed because they're being litigated, every single one of those settlements has an exclusive license. It's impossible to settle a case, a patent case, if the generic can't get the same exclusivity in settlement that he would get or she would get if they won the case under the Federal Hatch-Waxman Act. And so it's a binary choice.
Case saying, I'm currently engaged in settlement negotiations in some confidential case. I would be inclined to enter into a settlement agreement, which has been offered to me by the brand drug company. But I'm not going to. I'm going to pause, or I'm not going to take that step because I'm concerned about the imposition of penalties under ABA 24. I didn't see anything even close to that. If there was one declaration that said that, I might think, well, there's at least one indication of an imminent impending injury. But I didn't see that. What do you think is the closest?
I think when the companies say that they are litigating ongoing patent cases and they will be forced to continue to litigate, that means they are changing their economic behavior. Our injury is just like the trapper's injury in the Davis case. And the Davis
case... Is this the only way to settle a case? I mean, you talked about licensing agreements, but this statute doesn't prohibit licensing agreements as long as the licensee doesn't also agree to restrict his sales or his research.
let me take a step back then and
explain. So, am I correct in reading the statute that way?
No.
If I'm litigating with a patent holder and I settle that litigation by saying, I'll pay you for a license and I'll continue to sell my goods in California, have I violated the statute?
You would unless you got an immediate entry. In other words, the only way that you could settle a statute
that's what a license does. License says no. Wait, stop.
Okay.
See, you're reading into a license here more than a license does. We're litigating, and I say, look, let's stop fighting. Give me a license, and they say, fine, you have a license, you can now sell. That doesn't violate the statute, does it?
If it's an exclusive license, it does violate the statute. And the only
way... how does it violate the statute?
Because the statute says, and I'm reading here from 13.4.002, the definition of...
A license is something of value. We all agree about that. Look at B. In addition... You must agree to forego research, development, manufacturing, marketing, or sales of the product. And I posited a case where the license allows you to sell your generic in California. Is there any problem under the statute?
There isn't if the entry is that day. But the problem is that if there's an entry that is that day, there's never a settlement. Because you have a patent case... The brand wants to continue to market its drug. The generic is
business model where they get the monopoly, as California puts it, they get the monopolistic profit for some period of time and then give a license. But if they gave the generic a license immediately and perhaps required them to give some part of the profits or whatever, some other economic deal, then the law wouldn't prohibit that, if I'm understanding it correctly.
As long as there is an exclusive license and the brand is letting the generic have exclusivity, which is the very same thing that Congress guarantees under the Hatch-Waxman Act, then this statute, even if you could come in the market significantly before in a settlement, you would otherwise come in if you actually successfully beat the patent. This statute says it's unlawful.
I don't see where it says that. See, I don't know where you find that in the statute. Sub B says you must agree that your client, the generic, to forego research, development, manufacturing, or marketing or sales of the product for a period of time. And I'm positing a settlement where the patent holder says, buy a license from me and you can start marketing right away. No restrictions. Violate the statute, does it?
That would not be a settlement, Your Honor. That would be the brand company saying, before I even get to trial...
Sure it would be a settlement. I'll charge you $10 for the license rather than the $1 million I wanted to charge you at the beginning. I'll give you the license on favorable terms. There's all kinds of settlements of cases that don't involve agreements that violate this statute. Can we agree on that?
I think we could agree on that, but I don't think you can settle a brand generic case without getting an exclusive license and some period after the date on the settlement before which the generic can market the drug. And in the way the statute works, if you have a case that's supposed to be tried 6 months from now and you settle now, by settling today and letting you in the market 30 days from now, that's far more competitive than if you litigated and beat the patent and you came on in a year. And yet, if the settlement gave you that right to come in a week from now or a day from now with an exclusive license, it would violate the statute. But again, Your Honor,
we're missing each other here, but I'm still not, and maybe Judge Akuta will be kind to give you another minute at the end, but I'm still not clear why this exclusive licensing agreement violates the statute. I can't find any way it violates sub B of the statute, because your client hasn't agreed to do any of the things that sub B forbids.
Because unless the branded company simply says, I'm not going to defend the patent, you can come in today, which is not the way in which any settlement works, you can't have that type of settlement. But Your Honor, I see my time is running. I just want to make the point that to the extent that this statute is regulating and making the object of its conduct out of state, I think, as the court seems to recognize, that would create a dormant commerce clause problem. I understand the question is, are the affidavits, do they give rise to the immediacy? And I think the economic harm that we face is the same harm that we face, that the trappers face. Because there is this law that restricts certain types of activity, we are forced to spend more money litigating these cases. The Zaitis affidavit actually discloses a list of ongoing patent cases.
Okay, well, you're over time. We'll give you a minute for rebuttal. We'll hear from the other side.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Carly Eisenberg on behalf of the California Attorney General Javier Becerra. Your Honors, I'd like to begin by describing what AB 824 is and what it does not do. AB 824 is an evidentiary burden-shifting statute. It represents a modest but important change to California's antitrust laws. It does not ban settlement agreements, nor does it force pharmaceutical companies to litigate cases to judgment. AB 824 merely creates rebuttable presumptions, and there is nothing unlawful or unconstitutional about a state legislature creating such an evidentiary framework. And to be
3402A1, it says that this type of pay for delay agreement shall be presumed to have an anti-competitive effect and shall be a violation of this section. So that seems to be more than an evidentiary presumption. And how do you explain that?
You're right, Your Honor. It does impose penalties, which makes it somewhat distinct from the Cartwright Act because it has additional...
Oh, a penalty. I mean, potentially a bet your company penalty, a minimum $20 million. So it's not merely shifting the burden.
Well, correct. But under federal antitrust law and state antitrust law, these reverse payments are already unlawful. We know that from the activist case and the Cipro case.
No, we don't know that from activists. What we know from activists is that they might be unlawful if they violate the rule of reason. We know that somebody could prove that in a particular case, it's an unreasonable settlement, but they're not per se unlawful, are they?
Correct, Your Honor, Judge Hurwitz. I misspoke. It's just, I meant to point to activists and to the extent that the patents are not immune from antitrust scrutiny was the holding from activists. I'd like to begin with a threshold question about standing and injury. And here, plaintiff has not demonstrated concrete and particular harm that's actual or imminent. As Your Honors pointed out, their declarations are woefully inadequate in terms of identifying a single settlement agreement, a single piece of litigation, or any type of ongoing negotiation that's been impacted by AB 824. I think the district court got it right at ER 11 when it said this would be a completely different case had they made any type of those allegations. And the state agrees. And that's why the district court denied the preliminary injunction without prejudice. It's not to foreclose AAM forever from challenging AB 824, but it's based on the strategic decision that they made in bringing six nearly identical declarations on a pre-enforcement challenge that do not contain specific facts showing concrete and particularized harm that's imminent. Lujan says these someday intentions are without a description of a concrete plan is simply not imminent injury. And so,
is it in your view, did they lack standing, or simply did they fail to demonstrate sufficient immediate harm to get a preliminary injunction?
Your Honor, I think it's both. In this court's case, in Thomas,
well, if it's both, shouldn't the district judge have dismissed the case? If there's no standing, you can't continue to litigate.
You're right. And on that point, we do disagree with the district court. The district court said that the AAM had standing based on the fact that they were in current litigation and that there was potential financial monetary penalties. And we think that that holding was erroneous for the reasons that Your Honors mentioned, that first off, the penalties would incur by invoking a speculative chain of events, no point of that chain has been demonstrated.
So if they were to refile tomorrow, and let's assume it should have been dismissed, or if we sent it back to the district court one way or another, and Mr. Lefkowitz got a more artfully worded declaration from one of his clients which said, we're now in settlement negotiations with, we're trying to settle a case and we'd like to propose one of these reverse payouts, but we're scared to because, well, we won't, because we know if they accept it, we'll then have to litigate with a $20 million penalty over our head. Would that be enough to establish standing?
Your Honor, I do think that brings them within the imminence that's required for our.
Okay, so what you mean, I have no doubt he's able to gin up one of those affidavits if he has to. Should we send it back to the district court and say, you're right, but he will have standing if he does this? Or what should we do in this case?
I think that that's correct. I think it would be affirming the district court's denial of the preliminary injunction, or separately concluding that sua sponte review in terms of jurisdiction has unavailed, that AAM hasn't satisfied Article III jurisdiction, but it doesn't preclude AAM from potentially amending its complaint and doing so at the district court level. I think that...
Clarify, if we say it should be dismissed for lack of jurisdiction, we can't discuss the preliminary injunction ruling. Isn't that right?
I think that's correct, Your Honor. That would be right.
Yeah, and that's what I was asking. And if we dismiss for lack of jurisdiction, maybe he can refile and correct the problem. But I don't think we can remand to the district court and say maybe he can fix his jurisdictional problems. Can we?
I think that what's interesting is that they never obtained an injunction from either the district court or this court. So we have the benefit of 7 months of AB 824 actually having taken effect. So we actually know how AB 824 has impacted these pharmaceutical companies. And to the extent the court's interested in extra record evidence, it would demonstrate that.
No, I'm not. And the problem is we don't know because there is no evidence. That's one of the problems. See, that's why I think it's likely that somebody, if we said we agree with the state, if only the affidavit said I have a plan of entering into this kind of settlement, but it's been aborted because of the California statute, you say that's probably enough to give them standing and raise the issue. Aren't we surely going to get one of those affidavits back?
I don't think that that's certain, Your Honor. I think that AAM has had the district court denied the preliminary injunction without prejudice. So since that denial, AAM could have brought a new motion for a preliminary injunction with new declarations attached that would have satisfied the district court's concerns with regard to ripeness. And we've not seen AAM take those actions in the district court. And to be clear, AAM can bring a pre-enforcement challenge. They could put forth the facts that you all are talking about and satisfy this court's both the injury in fact part of the analysis and the ripeness part of the analysis as well. It's just based on the current record that's before the court, they haven't done so. And I think—
Can I ask you a question on a different topic?
Yes, sir.
Does California intend to enforce this statute in the case of agreements made out of state?
Your Honor, the statute is very clear that it's tied to sales of a pharmaceutical product, and that's in California. AAM would have this court read that language out of the statute, and we would—
I'm not asking you for their position on the law or a description of the statute. I'm asking you whether or not the Attorney General can tell us whether or not he intends to enforce this law with respect to agreements made outside the borders of California.
Consistent with longstanding antitrust principles, the California Attorney General will enforce the statute that is tied to in-state sales that are made, that are wrongful charges of monopolistic prices. Now, as this court held in Nebelbard, the conduct complained of, that antitrust behavior, is not just those depressed prices or monopolistic prices in California, but it's where those bad actors engaged in that behavior.
So your answer to my question is yes. To the extent that people who enter into these agreements later make sales in California, you will enforce this statute against them.
Your Honor, yes, that's consistent with how antitrust law has long been applied.
I'm not looking for the legal argument, because one of the issues in the case that deals with standing is if the AG were to say, no, we don't intend to enforce this against out-of-state agreements, we'd have no dormant commerce clause problem, I think. But you're saying we do intend to enforce it. whether or not that creates a dormant commerce clause problem is a separate issue. I just want to find out your intentions.
Yes, I think that we plan to follow the plain language of the statute, which ties the agreements to the sales. And so the Attorney General plans to enforce the statute for those in-state sales. And this court has repeatedly held that a state can legislate in-state sales. That's the foie gras case, the shark fin case, even Rocky Mountain in terms of fuel consumed by California consumers, and even San Francisco. There were two parts of the statute, and the part of the statute that dealt with in-state sales, no one disputed California had the authority to do that. And here, I think Your Honor's decision in the shark fin case is illustrates that the California legislature, when it, even though a statute may not have a geographic limitation, that's certainly how this court has interpreted statutes. The very first line of the Chinatown case describes the California statute as the unlawful, that it being unlawful for any person to possess, sell, offer for trade, sale or trade, the distribution of a shark fin, close quote. And then this court said in California, and that's precisely what AB 824 does. It prohibits agreements in connection with the sale of a pharmaceutical product in California. And this is consistent.
Tell me where it says that. What does it say in California?
The in California does not appear in the statute, just like it did not appear in the shark fin statute at issue, but exactly how this court construed that statute. And that's consistent with how this court construes statutes and indeed the California law.
No, I understand that. You kept saying it's exactly what the statute says, but it doesn't say that, does it?
I'm sorry. It does say in connection with the sale of a pharmaceutical product, close quote, and I'm saying that it's with regard to in California. And
In your brief, you said that California courts take the position that there's a presumption that the laws don't apply extraterritorially. So does that apply to agreements? Because you're saying, no, that the extraterritoriality of where the agreements took place don't matter. The only thing that matters is where the sales take place. Can you explain how your understanding of how California law applies there?
Right. Well, I think that presumption is in looking at the statute. And so we would urge this court to follow those California canons of construction. But I think, but in looking at the dormant commerce clause, the federal question following Neville Bard is completely consistent with the interpretation we're asking the court to apply here in terms of California being concerned about agreements to sell to California consumers or agreements not to sell to California consumers. So it's that direct nexus to California consumers, and it's with regard to changed prices in California that the California legislature was concerned about. And it's not just the statutory text and the canons that support that, but the California legislative history dictates that the legislature was concerned about sales and costs, and that's reflected at SER 3, 4, and 5.
Opposing counsel says Neville Bard is distinguishable because in that case there was substantial in-state activity. You agree with that?
I disagree with the characterization because I think what happened there, it's reflected on page 990 and 991 of the decision, is the court concluded that the actual rigging of the prices, so the bad actors and the bad behavior, was actually in Wisconsin with the cheesemakers, but the conduct in terms of the sales was in California. And so this court held that the Cartwright Act applied not just to the sales in California, but applied to that conduct in Wisconsin where the rigging actually took place. So I think it's entirely consistent. And if this court had any doubts, the Seventh Circuit and In Re Brand Name came to the exact same outcome, a decision by Judge Posner about applying Alabama antitrust law. And even the decision cited by AAM in its reply brief, the In Re Lorazepam, a D.C. District Court case, there too they said the Illinois Antitrust Act applied not only to acts wholly within the state, but acts that occurred outside the state when it came to the antitrust law.
Well, but I read the Seventh Circuit opinion. It didn't say it applied to acts wholly outside the state. It said it can apply to acts outside the state if there are acts in the state. My question is, what does San Francis do to your argument? There's broad language in San Francis, quoting the Supreme Court, that says the state lacks the ability under the Commerce Clause to regulate conduct that occurs entirely outside of the state. Why isn't the conduct you're regulating here the entering into the agreement, not the subsequent sales? There's nothing in the statute about the sales. It's only about entering into the agreement.
Your Honor, I would disagree with that. The first line of the statute talks about the sales, and the regulation of the agreement is in connection with the sale. It's at section 13.4002A1. It specifically says with the sale of a pharmaceutical product. And so and as Sam Francis noted,
I only read that to describe the limited field that you were talking about, which is pharmaceutical products as opposed to others. Is there anything in this statute that, see, the statute seems to regulate the entering into the agreement, doesn't it? Not the subsequent marketing in California.
Your Honor, we would urge the court to follow Rosenblatt and this court's canons of construction and the California canons of construction, and to include in the interpretation that the sale of a pharmaceutical product is within California. Your Honors, I see my time is up. We would ask that the court, we respectfully request that this court affirm the district court's opinion.
We thank you for your argument. We'll give you Mr. Lefkowitz, a minute for rebuttal.
Okay, I'll be brief then. And I want to say I'm very happy to be able to agree with you, Judge Hurwitz. The Knievel-Bard case makes very clear and relies on the fact that some of the unlawful conduct under the Cartwright Act was the purchases of the bid-rigged cheese by the defendant in the state of California.
The sales of pharmaceuticals within the state of California. In Knievel-Bard, it was the purchases. In this case, opposing counsel says it's the sales. Isn't that the same thing?
No, because this statute, unlike the Cartwright Act, doesn't regulate the sales. The sale might be a trigger. They might say, contra to the language of the statute, which has a $20 million penalty, even if there's no sale in California, they might say we won't use the statute if there isn't a sale, but that doesn't matter. You have to look at what is the object of the regulation. The object of the regulation is the entering into of the settlement. If I enter into a settlement and the settlement's in Delaware and California says that act of settlement is unlawful, that violates the Constitution. They've told us that that's how they are going to interpret this and implement it. And I think at this point, our injury is per se, and it's immediate. And I would say, Your Honor, that if you look at the Knievel-Bard case, the reason that they could decide that case and then Sam Francis could decide the way it came out, consistent with Healy and Baldwin, of course, required a sale within the state, was because you have to focus on what is the actual conduct that violates the law.
Okay. You're way well over your time. I think we have your argument. Appreciate both parties' argument in this interesting case, and the case of Association for Accessible Medicines versus Xavier Becerra is submitted. And that's your argument in Andrew Dorman versus Intuit Inc.